No, I've been variously described, but nobody's yet explained me away as a ghost. As I spoke, I chanced to look to my right, and saying ghost, saw one, dark, in dark clothing, still and shadowy. He sat at my elbow, the specter at the feast. Obzel's attention had been taken up by his other neighbor, and most people were listening to Slos at the head of the table. I said in a low voice, I didn't expect to see you here, Lord Estravan. The unexpected is what makes life possible, he said. I was entrusted with a message for you. He looked inquiring. It takes a form of money, some of your own. Forth Remir Osbeth sends it. I have it with me at Mr. Shuska's house. I'll see that it comes to you. It's kind of you, Mr. I. He was quiet, subdued, reduced, a banished man living off his wits in a foreign land. He seemed disinclined to talk with me, and I was glad not to talk with him. Yet now and then, during that long, heavy, talkative supper party, though all my attention was given to those complex and powerful Orgata who meant to befriend or use me, I was sharply aware of him, of his silence, of his dark, averted face. And it crossed my mind, though I dismissed the idea as baseless, that I had not come to Mishinori to eat roast blackfish with the commensals of my own free will. Nor had they brought me here. He had. Chapter 9. Estravan the Traitor. An East Karhaidish tale as told in Gorenhering by Tobard Chorhawa and recorded by G.A. The story is well known in various versions, and a Haban play based on it is in the repertory of traveling players east of the Kargav. Long ago, before the days of King Argovan, I, who made Karhide one kingdom, there was blood feud between the domain of Stok and the domain of Ester in Kermland. The feud had been fought in forays and ambushes for three generations, and there was no settling it, for it was a dispute over land. Rich land is scarce in Kerm, and a domain's pride is in the length of its borders. And the lords of Kermland are proud men and umbrageous men, casting black shadows. It chanced that the heir of the flesh of the Lord of Ester, a young man, skiing across Icefoot Lake in the month of Irem, hunting Pestri, came on to rotten ice and fell into the lake. Though by using one ski as a lever on a firmer ice edge, he pulled himself up out of the water at last, he was in almost as bad case out of the lake as in it, for he was drenched. The air was Kurum, damp weather, 0 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and night was coming on. He saw no hope of reaching Ester 8 miles away, uphill, and so set off towards the village of Ebos on the north shore of the lake. As night fell, the fog flowed down off the glacier and spread out all across the lake, so that he could not see his way, nor where to set his skis. Slowly he went for fear of rotten ice, yet in haste, because the cold was at his bones, and before long he would not be able to move. He saw at last a light before him in the night and fog. He cast off his skis, for the lake shore was rough going and bare of snow in places. His legs would not well hold him up any more, and he struggled as best he could to the light. He was far astray from the way to Ebos. This was a small house set by itself in a forest of the Thor trees that are all the woods of Kermland. And they grew close all about the house, and no taller than its roof. He beat at the door with his hands and called aloud, and one opened the door and brought him into firelight. There was no else there, only this one person alone. He took Estravan's clothes off him that were like clothes of iron with the ice, and put him naked between furs, and with the warmth of his own body drove out the frost from Estravan's feet and hands and face, and gave him hot ale to drink. At last the young man was recovered, and looked on the one who cared for him. This was a stranger, young as himself. They looked at each other. Each of them was comely, strong of frame and fine of feature, straight and dark. Estevan saw that the fire of Kemmer was in the face of the other. He said, "I am Arik of Esther." The other said, "I am Theram of Stock." Then Estevan laughed, for he was still weak, and said, "Did you warm me back to life in order to kill me, Stockfin?" The other said, "No." He put out his hand and touched Estevan's hand, as if he were making certain that the frost was driven out. At the touch, though Estevan was a day or two from his kemmer, he felt the fire waken in himself. So for a while both held still, their hands touching. "They are the same," said Stockfin, and laying his palm against Estevan's showed it was so. Their hands were the same in length and form, finger by finger, matching like the two hands of one man laid palm to palm. "I have never seen you before," Stockfin said. "We are mortal enemies." He rose and built up the fire in the hearth and returned to sit by Estevan. "We are mortal enemies," said Estevan. "I would swear Kemmering with you." "And I with you," said the other. Then they vowed Kemmering to each other, and in Kermland then, as now, that vow of faithfulness is not to be broken, not to be replaced. That night and the day that followed, and the night that followed, they spent in the hut in the forest by the frozen lake. On the next morning, a party of men from Stock came to the hut. One of them knew young Estevan by sight. He said no word and gave no warning, but drew his knife, and there in Stockfin's sight stabbed Estevan in the throat and chest, and the young man fell across the cold hearth in his blood, dead. "He was the heir of Esther," the murderer said. Stockfin said, "Put him on your sledge and take him to Esther for burial." He went back to Stock. The men set off with Estevan's body on the sledge, but they left it far in the Thor forest for wild beasts to eat, and returned that night to Stock. Theram stood up before his parent in the flesh, Lord Harish Rem Irstokvin, and said to the men, "Did you do as I bid you?" They answered, "Yes." Theram said, "You lie, for you would never have come back alive from Esther. These men have disobeyed my command and lied to hide their disobedience. I ask their banishment." Lord Harish granted it, and they were driven out of hearth and law. Soon after this, Theram left his domain, saying that he wished to indwell at Rothera Fastness for a time, and he did not return to Stock until a year had passed. Now in the domain of Esther, they sought for Arik in mountain and plain, and then mourned for him. Bitter the mourning through summer and autumn, for he had been the Lord's one child of the flesh. But in the end of the month Thurn, when winter lay heavy on the land, a man came up the mountainside on skis and gave to the warder at Esther Gate a bundle wrapped in furs, saying, "This is Theram, the son's son of Esther." Then he was down the mountain on his skis like a rock skipping over water, gone before any thought to hold him. In the bundle of furs lay a newborn child weeping. They brought the child in to Lord Sorv and told him the stranger's words. And the old lord, full of grief, saw in the baby his lost son, Arik. He ordered that the child be reared as a son of the inner hearth and that he be called Theram, though that was not a name ever used by the clan of Esther. The child grew comely, fine, and strong. He was dark of nature and silent, yet all saw in him some likeness to the lost Arik. When he was grown, Lord Sorv, in the willfulness of old age, named him heir of Esther. Then there were swollen hearts among Sorv's Kemmering sons, all strong men in their prime who had waited long for lordship. They laid ambush against young Theram when he went out alone hunting Pestheri in the month of Irem. But he was armed and not taken unawares. Two of his hearth brothers he shot in the fog that lay thick on Icefoot Lake in the thaw weather, and a third he fought with knife to knife and killed at last, though he himself was wounded on the chest and neck with deep cuts. Then he stood above his brother's body in the mist over the ice and saw that night was falling. He grew sick and weak as the blood ran from his wounds, and he thought to go to Ebo's village for help. But in the gathering dark he went astray and came to the Thor forest on the east shore of the lake. There, seeing an abandoned hut, he entered it, and too faint to light a fire, he fell down on the cold stones of the hearth and lay so, with his wounds unstanched. One came in out of the night, a man alone. He stopped in the doorway and was still, staring at the man who lay in his blood across the hearth. Then he entered in haste and made a bed of furs that he took out of an old chest, and built up a fire, and cleaned Therum's wounds and bound them. When he saw the young man look at him, he said, "I am Therum of Stock." "I am Therum of Ester." There was silence a while between them. Then the young man smiled and said, "Did you bind up my wounds in order to kill me, Stockman?" "No," said the older one. Estrivan asked, "How does it chance that you, the Lord of Stock, are here on disputed land alone?" "I come here often," Stockman replied. He felt the young man's pulse and hand for fever, and for an instant laid his palm flat to Estrivan's palm, and finger by finger their two hands matched, like the two hands of one man. "We are mortal enemies," said Stockman. Estrivan answered, "We are mortal enemies. Yet I have never seen you before." Stockman turned aside his face. "Once I saw you long ago," he said. "I wish there might be peace between our houses." Estrivan said, "I will vow peace with you." So they made that vow, and then spoke no more, and the hurt man slept. In the morning, Stockman was gone, but a party of people from Ebo's village came to the hut and carried Estrivan home to Ester. There, none dared longer oppose the old lord's will, the rightness of which was written plain in three men's blood on the lake ice. And at Sorv's death, Therum became lord of Ester. Within the year, he ended the old feud, giving up half the disputed lands to the domain of Stock. For this, and for the murder of his hearth brothers, he was called Estrivan the Traitor. Yet his name, Therum, is still given to children of that domain. Chapter 10. Conversations in Mishnori. Next morning, as I finished a late breakfast served to me in my suite in Shuskus mansion, the house phone emitted a polite bleat. When I switched it on, the caller spoke in Karhidish. "Therum Harth here. May I come up?" "Please do." I was glad to get the confrontation over with at once. It was plain that no tolerable relationship could exist between Estrivan and myself. Even though his disgrace and exile were at least nominally on my account, I could take no responsibility for them, feel no rational guilt. He had made neither his acts nor his motives clear to me in Aran Rang, and I could not trust the fellow. I wished that he was not mixed up with these Argata, who had, as it were, adopted me. His presence was a complication and an embarrassment. He was shown into the room by one of the many house employees. I had him sit down in one of the large padded chairs and offered him breakfast ale. He refused. His manner was not constrained. He had left shyness a long way behind him, if he ever had any, but it was restrained, tentative, aloof. "The first real snow," he said, and seeing my glance at the heavily curtained window, "you haven't looked out yet?" I did so, and saw snow whirling thick on a light wind down the street, over the whitened roofs. 2 or 3 inches had fallen in the night. It was Adarhad Gore, the 17th of the first month of autumn. "It's early," I said, caught by the snow spell for a moment. "They predict a hard winter this year." I left the curtains drawn back. The bleak, even light from outside fell on his dark face. He looked older. He had known some hard times since I saw him last in the corner red dwelling of the palace in Aran Rang by his own fireside. "I have here what I was asked to bring you," I said, and gave him the foil-skin-wrapped packet of money, which I had set out on a table, ready after his call. He took it and thanked me gravely. I had not sat down. After a moment, still holding the packet, he stood up. My conscience itched a little, but I did not scratch it. I wanted to discourage him from coming to me. That this involved humiliating him was unfortunate. He looked straight at me. He was shorter than I, of course, short-legged and compact, not as tall even as many women of my race. Yet when he looked at me, he did not seem to be looking up at me. I did not meet his eyes. I examined the radio on the table with a show of abstracted interest. "One can't believe everything one hears on that radio here," he said pleasantly. "Yet it seems to me that here in Mishnori, you are going to be in some need of information and advice." There seemed to be a number of people quite ready to supply it. "And there's safety in numbers, eh? 10 are more trustworthy than one. Excuse me, I shouldn't use Karhaidish, I forgot." He went on in Argata. "Banished men should never speak their native tongue. It comes bitter from their mouth. And this language suits a traitor better, I think. Drips off one's teeth like sugar syrup. Mr. I have the right to thank you. You performed a service both for me and for my old friend in Kemmering, Asher Forath. And in his name and mine, I claim my right. My thanks take the form of advice." He paused. I said nothing. I had never heard him use this sort of harsh, elaborate courtesy, and had no idea what it signified. He went on. "You are, in Mishnori, what you were not in Erenrang. There they said you were. Here, they'll say you're not. You are the tool of a faction. I advise you to be careful how you let them use you. I advise you to find out what the enemy faction is and who they are, and never to let them use you, for they will not use you well." He stopped. I was about to demand that he be more specific, but he said, "Goodbye, Mr. I," turned and left. I stood benumbed. The man was like an electric shock, nothing to hold on to, and you don't know what hit you. He had certainly spoiled the mood of peaceful self-congratulation in which I had eaten breakfast. I went to the narrow window and looked out. The snow had thinned a little. It was beautiful, drifting in white clots and clusters like a fall of cherry petals in the orchards of my home, when a spring wind blows down the green slopes of Borland where I was born. On earth, warm earth, where trees bear flowers in spring. All at once I was utterly downcast and homesick. 2 years I had spent on this damned planet, and the third winter had begun before autumn was underway. Months and months of unrelenting cold, sleet, ice, wind, rain, snow, cold. Cold inside, cold outside, cold to the bone and the marrow of the bone. And all that time on my own, alien and isolate, without a soul I could trust. Poor Genli. Shall we cry? I saw Estevan come out of the house onto the street below me, a dark, foreshortened figure in the even, vague gray-white of the snow. He looked about, adjusting the loose belt of his yeb. He wore no coat. He set off down the street, walking with a deft, definite grace, a quickness of being that made him seem in that moment the only thing alive in all Mishnori. I turned back to the warm room. Its comforts were stuffy and cloddish. The heater, the padded chairs, the bed piled with furs, the rugs, drapes, wrappings, mufflings. I put on my winter coat and went out for a walk, in a disagreeable mood, in a disagreeable world. I was to lunch that day with Commensal's Absalonyegi and others I had met the night before, and to be introduced to some I had not met. Lunch is usually served from a buffet and eaten standing up, perhaps so that one will not feel he has spent the entire day sitting at table. For this formal affair, however, places were set at table, and the buffet was enormous, 18 or 20 hot and cold dishes, mostly variations on subby eggs and bread apple. At the sideboard, before the taboo on conversation applied, Absal remarked to me while loading up his plate with batter-fried subby eggs, The fellow named Merson is a spy from Erenrang, and Gom there is an open agent of the Sarf, you know. He spoke conversationally, laughed as if I had made an amusing reply, and moved off to the pickled blackfish. I had no idea what the Sarf was. As people were beginning to sit down, a young fellow came in and spoke to the host, Yegi, who then turned to us. "News from Karhide," he said. "King Argovit's child was born this morning and died within the hour." There was a pause and a buzz, and then the handsome man called Gom laughed and lifted up his beer tankard. "May all the kings of Karhide live as long," he cried. Some drank the toast with him. Most did not. "Name of Meshe, to laugh at a child's death," said a fat old man in purple, sitting heavily down beside me. His leggings bunched around his thighs like skirts, his face heavy with disgust. Discussion arose as to which of his Kemmering sons Argovan might name as his heir, for he was well over 40, and would now surely have no child of his flesh, and how long he might leave Tibby as regent. Some thought the regency would be ended at once, others were dubious. "What do you think, Mr. I?" asked the man called Merson, whom Absol had identified as a Karhidish agent, and thus presumably one of Tibby's own men. "You've just come from Erenrang. What are they saying there about these rumors that Argovan has in fact abdicated without announcement, handed the sledge over to his cousin?" "Well, I've heard the rumor, yes. Do you think it's got any foundation?" "I have no idea," I said. And at this point, the host intervened with a mention of the weather, for people had begun to eat. After servants had cleared away the plates and the mountainous wreckage of roasts and pickles from the buffet, we all sat on around the long table. Small cups of a fierce liqueur were served, life water they called it, as men often do, and they asked me questions. Since my examination by the physicians and scientists of Erenrang, I had not been faced with a group of people who wanted me to answer their questions. Few Karhiders, even the fishermen and farmers with whom I had spent my first months, had been willing to satisfy their curiosity, which was often intense, by simply asking. They were involute, introvert, indirect. They did not like questions and answers. I thought of Otherhord Fastness, of what facts the weaver had said concerning answers. Even the experts had limited their questions to strictly physiological subjects, such as the glandular and circulatory functions in which I differed most notably from the Gathenian norm. They had never gone on to ask, for example, how the continuous sexuality of my race influenced its social institutions, how we handled our permanent Kemmer. They listened when I told them. The psychologists listened when I told them about mind speech. But not one of them had brought himself to ask enough general questions to form any adequate picture of Terran or ecumenical society, except, perhaps, Estravan. Here they weren't quite so tied up by considerations of everybody's prestige and pride, and questions evidently were not insulting either to the asker or the one questioned. However, I soon saw that some of the questioners were out to catch me, to prove me a fraud. That threw me off balance a minute. I had, of course, met with incredulity in Karhide, but seldom with a will to incredulity. Tibby had put on an elaborate show of going along with the hoax the day of the parade in Erenrang, but as I now knew, that was part of the game he had played to discredit Estravan, and I guessed that Tibby did in fact believe me. He had seen my ship, after all, the little lander that had brought me down on the planet. He had free access, along with anyone else, to the engineer's reports on the ship and the Ansible. None of these Argata had seen the ship. I could show them the Ansible, but it didn't make a very convincing alien artifact, being so incomprehensible as to fit in with hoax as well as with reality. The old law of cultural embargo stood against the importation of analyzable, imitable artifacts at this stage, and so I had nothing with me except the ship and Ansible, my box of pictures, the indubitable peculiarity of my body, and the unprovable singularity of my mind. The pictures passed around the table and were examined with the noncommittal expression you see on the faces of people looking at pictures of somebody else's family. The questioning continued. What, asked Obzel, was the ecumen? A world? A league of worlds? A place? A government? Well, all of those and none. Ecumen is our Terran word. In the common tongue, it's called the household. In Karhidish, it would be the hearth. In Argata, I'm not sure. I don't know the language well enough yet. Not the commensality, I think, though there are undoubtedly similarities between the commensal government and the ecumen. But the ecumen is not essentially a government at all. It is an attempt to reunify the mystical with the political, and as such, is, of course, mostly a failure. But its failure has done more good for humanity so far than the successes of its predecessors. It is a society, and it has, at least potentially, a culture. It is a form of education. In one aspect, it's a sort of very large school. Very large indeed. The motives of communication and cooperation are of its essence. And therefore, in another aspect, it's a league or union of worlds, possessing some degree of centralized conventional organization. It's this aspect, the league, that I now represent. The ecumen as a political entity functions through coordination, not by rule. It does not enforce laws. Decisions are reached by counsel and consent, not by consensus or command. As an economic entity, it is immensely active, looking after inter-world communication, keeping the balance of trade among the 80 worlds, 84 to be precise, if Geffen enters the ecumen. What do you mean, it doesn't enforce its laws, said Slos? It hasn't any. Member states follow their own laws. When they clash, the ecumen mediates, attempts to make a legal or ethical adjustment or collation or choice. Now, if the ecumen, as an experiment in the superorganic, does eventually fail, it will have to become a peacekeeping force, develop a police, and so on. But at this point, there's no need. All the central worlds are still recovering from a disastrous era a couple of centuries ago, reviving lost skills and lost ideas, learning how to talk again. How could I explain the age of the enemy and its after effects to a people who had no word for war? This is absolutely fascinating, Mr. I, said the host, Commensal Yegi, a delicate, dapper, drawling fellow with keen eyes. But I can't see what they'd want with us. I mean to say, what particular good is an 84th world to them? And not, I take it, a very clever world, for we don't have starships and so on, as they all do. None of us did until the Hainish and the Sishans arrived, and some worlds still weren't allowed to for centuries, until the ecumen established the canons for what I think you here call open trade. That got a laugh all around, for it was the name of Yegi's party, or faction within the commensality. Open trade is really what I'm here to try to set up. Trade not only in goods, of course, but in knowledge, technologies, ideas, philosophies, art, medicine, science, theory. I doubt that Geffen would ever do much physical coming and going to the other worlds. We are 17 light years here from the nearest ecumenical world, Alu, a planet of the star you call Asimosi. The farthest is 250 light years away, and you cannot even see its star. With the Ansible communicator, you could talk with that world as if by radio with the next town, but I doubt you'd ever meet any people from it. The kind of trade I speak of can be highly profitable, but it consists largely of simple communication rather than of transportation. My job here is really to find out if you're willing to communicate with the rest of mankind. You, Slos repeated, leaning forward intensely, does that mean Orgrin, or does it mean Geffen as a whole? I hesitated a moment, for it was not the question I had expected. Here and now, it means Orgrin, but the contract cannot be exclusive. If Sith or the island nations or Karhide decide to enter the ecumen, they may. It's a matter of individual choice each time. Then, what generally happens on a planet as highly developed as Geffen is that the various anthrotypes or regions or nations end up by establishing a set of representatives to function as coordinator on the planet and with the other planets, a local stability in our terms. A lot of time is saved by beginning this way, and money by sharing the expense. If you decided to set up a starship of your own, for instance. "By the milk of Meshi," said Fat Hummery beside me. "You want us to go shooting off into the void?" He wheezed like the high notes of an accordion in disgust and amusement. Gaum spoke. "Where is your ship, Mr. I?" He put the question softly, half smiling, as if it were extremely subtle, and he wished the subtlety to be noticed. He was a most extraordinary handsome human being, by any standards, and as either sex, and I couldn't help staring at him as I answered, and also wondered again what the Sarf was. "Why, that's no secret. It was talked about a good bit on the Karhidish radio. The rocket that landed me on Horden Island is now in the Royal Workshop Foundry in the Artisan School. Most of it, anyway. I think various experts went off with the various bits of it after they'd examined it." "Rocket?" inquired Hummery, for I had used the Orgato word for firecracker. "It succinctly describes the method of propulsion of the landing boat, sir." Hummery wheezed some more. Gaum merely smiled, saying, "Then you have no means of returning to, well, wherever you came from." "Oh, yes, I could speak to Alul by Ansible and ask them to send me a Nafal ship to pick me up. It would get here in 17 years. Or I could radio to the starship that brought me into your solar system. It's in orbit around your sun now. It would get here in a matter of days." The sensation that caused was visible and audible, and even Gaum couldn't hide his surprise. There was some discrepancy here. This was the one major fact I had kept concealed in Karhide, even from Estravan. If, as I had been given to understand, the Argata knew about me only what Karhide had chosen to tell them, then this should have been only one among many surprises. But it wasn't. It was the big one. "Where is this ship, sir?" Yegi demanded. "Orbiting the sun, somewhere between Gethin and Kuhern." "How did you get from it to here?" "By the firecracker," said old Hummery. "Precisely. We don't land an interstellar ship on a populated planet until open communication or alliance is established. So I came in on a little rocket boat and landed on Horden Island." "And you can get in touch with the big ship by ordinary radio, Mr. I?" That was Obsol. "Yes. I omitted mention for the present of my little relay satellite set into orbit from the rocket. I did not want to give them the impression that their sky was full of my junk. It would take a fairly powerful transmitter, but you have plenty of those." "Then we could radio your ship?" "Yes, if you had the proper signal. The people aboard are in a condition we call stasis, hibernation, you might say, so that they won't lose out of their lives the years they spend waiting for me to get my business done down here. The proper signal on the proper wavelength will set machinery in motion, which will bring them out of stasis, after which they'll consult with me by radio or by Ansible, using Alul as relay center." Someone asked uneasily, "How many of them?" 11. That brought a little sound of relief, a laugh. The tension relaxed a little. "What if you never signaled?" Obsol asked. "They'll come out of stasis automatically about 4 years from now." "Would they come here after you, then?" "Not unless they'd heard from me. They'd consult with the Stabiles on Alul and Hein by Ansible. Most likely they'd decide to try again, send out another person as envoy. The second envoy often finds things easier than the first. He has less explaining to do, and people are likelier to believe him." Obsol grinned. Most of the others still looked thoughtful and guarded. Gaum gave me an airy little nod, as if applauding my quickness to reply, a conspirator's nod. Slos was staring bright-eyed and tense at some inner vision from which he turned abruptly to me. "Why," he said, "Mr. Envoy, did you never speak of this other ship during your 2 years in Karhide?" "How do we know that he didn't?" said Gaum, smiling. "We know damned well that he didn't, Mr. Gaum," said Yegi, also smiling. "I didn't," I said. "This is why. The idea of that ship waiting out there can be an alarming one. I think some of you find it so. In Carhide, I never advanced to a point of confidence with those I dealt with that allowed me to take the risk of speaking of the ship. Here, you've had longer to think about me. You're willing to listen to me out in the open, in public. You're not so much ruled by fear. I took the risk because I think the time has come to take it, and that Orgrin is the place. You are right, Mr. I. You are right, Sloth said violently. Within a month, you will send for that ship, and it will be made welcome in Orgrin as the visible sign and seal of the new epoch. Their eyes will be opened who will not see now. It went on, right on till dinner was served to us where we sat. We ate and drank and went home. I, for one, worn out, but pleased all in all with the way things had gone. There were warnings and obscurities, of course. Sloth wanted to make a religion of me. Gaum wanted to make a sham of me. Merson seemed to want to prove that he was not a Karhidish agent by proving that I was. But Obsal, Yegi, and some others were working on a higher level. They wanted to communicate with the Stabils and to bring the Nafal ship down on Argota ground in order to persuade or coerce the Commensality of Orgrin to ally itself with the Ecumen. They believed that in doing so, Orgrin would gain a large and lasting prestige victory over Carhide, and that the Commensals who engineered this victory would gain according prestige and power in their government. Their open trade faction, a minority in the 33, opposed the continuation of the Sinith Valley dispute and in general represented a conservative, unaggressive, non-nationalistic policy. They had been out of power for a long time and were calculating that their way back to power might, with some risks taken, lie on the road I pointed out. That they saw no farther than that, that my mission was a means to them and not an end, was no great harm. Once they were on the road, they might begin to get some sense of where it could take them. Meanwhile, if short-sighted, they were at least realistic. Obsal, speaking to persuade others, had said, "Either Carhide will fear the strength this alliance will give us, and Carhide is always afraid of new ways and new ideas, remember, and so will hang back and be left behind. Or else the Erenround government will get up their courage and come and ask to join, after us in second place. In either case, the Shrifgathor of Carhide will be diminished, and in either case, we drive the sledge. If we have the wits to take this advantage now, it will be a permanent advantage, and a certain one." Then turning to me, "But the Ecumen must be willing to help us, Mr. I. We have got to have more to show our people than you alone, one man, already known in Erenrong." "I see that, Commensal. You'd like a good showy proof, and I'd like to offer one. But I cannot bring down the ship until its safety and your integrity are reasonably secure. I need the consent and guarantee of your government, which I take it would mean the whole board of Commensals publicly announced." Obsal looked dour, but said, "Fair enough." Driving home with Shuskus, who had contributed nothing but his jovial laugh to the afternoon's business, I asked, "Mr. Shuskus, what is the SARF?" "One of the permanent bureaus of the internal administration. Looks out after false registries, unauthorized travel, job substitution, forgeries, that sort of thing. Trash. That's what SARF means in gutter or gata. Trash. It's a nickname."
"Then the inspectors are agents of the SARF?"
"Well, some are. And the police, I suppose, they come under its authority to some extent?" I put the question cautiously and was answered in kind. "I suppose so. I'm in the external administration, of course, and I can't keep all the offices straight over in internal." "They certainly are confusing. Now, what's the Waters office, for instance?" So I backed off as best I could from the subject of the SARF. What Shuskus had not said on the subject might have meant nothing at all to a man from Hine, say, or Lucky Shifwar. But I was born on Earth. It is not altogether a bad thing to have criminal ancestors. An arsonist grandfather may bequeath one a nose for smelling smoke. It had been entertaining and fascinating to find here on Gethin governments so similar to those in ancient histories of Terra, a monarchy and a genuine full-blown bureaucracy. This new development was also fascinating, but less entertaining. It was odd that in the less primitive society, the more sinister note was struck. So Gam, who wanted me to be a liar, was an agent of the secret police of Orgrin. Did he know that Absol knew him as such? No doubt he did. Was he then the agent provocateur? Was he nominally working with or against Absol's faction? Which of the factions within the government of 33 controlled or was controlled by the Sarf? I had better get these matters straight, but it might not be easy to do so. My course, which for a while had looked so clear and hopeful, seemed likely to become as torturous and beset with secrets as it had been in Erenrang. Everything had gone all right, I thought, until Estravan had appeared shadow-like at my side last night. "What's Lord Estravan's position here in Mishnori?" I asked Shuskis, who had settled back as if half asleep in the corner of the smooth-running car. "Estravan? Harth, he's called here, you know. We don't have titles in Orgrin. Dropped all that with the new epoch. Well, he's a dependent of Commensal Yegis, I understand." "He lives there?" "I believe so." I was about to say that it was odd that he had been at Slosa's last night and not at Yegi's today, when I saw that in the light of our brief morning interview, it wasn't very odd.